Today we are continuing walking through the book of Esther. Today we're going to be in chapter 2, so if you want to open your Bibles there right now, we're going to read through all of chapter 2. But today we're going to be looking at introduced to the two main characters of the story, Esther and Mordecai. Last week we were introduced to two minor characters, the king and the queen of Persia. And so we learned that King Xerxes was a prideful man who loved to show off how amazing his life was, and he also absolutely hated hearing the word no. And so when he held a huge party and all of his buddies got together and had a big drunken shindig for 7 days, and then he commanded his queen Vashti to come out to display her beauty for all the men to just... yeah, look at her in really dirty ways. She said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not doing it. But her refusal cost her position of being the queen. And that's ultimately the key point in the plot from chapter 1, because now there's a big now hiring sign and open position for the role of queen of Persia. Well, not necessarily that there is a now hiring sign at that moment, because here's one really important piece to this story that we have as we read through Esther. And that is, while we read it, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and it sounds like it's just moving really quickly together, there's actually these huge gaps in the story. So chapter 1 takes place in the third year of King Xerxes' reign. And chapter 2, where we're going to kick in today, where a new queen is chosen, happens in his seventh year of his reign. There's a four-year gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. And then when we go to chapter 3 next week, that's in the 12th year of his reign. And so before we even get into our text today, we've already got our first lesson. And that is that God is working across your lifetime, not just in a single moment. Additionally, he's weaving together all these events that may not seem connected to you in any way, but they all tie together in this super fascinating adventure called your life. We so often want life to be like a microwave. I want to put the food in 60 seconds and walk away with warmed up food. But that's not always good food. I told Michelle yesterday I ate something I'd warmed up and the rice was way too hot and the meat was still cold and it wasn't very good. God, on the other hand, has all these events in a stock pot, and he's just letting it simmer sometimes for years and stirring it and letting all the pieces come together and work together. And so I encourage each of you, regardless of the mess or the feelings that you have today, to understand everything you are facing is part of a bigger picture, and God sees it all. It reaches back further and moves ahead farther than you would ever imagine. But that's how God works through time. And so I hope that I've now set up a bit of anticipation for today's story. So let's jump in. Esther chapter 2, verse 1. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. He decreed that she could no longer be in his presence ever again. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. So notice the text never says that King Xerxes regretted his decision. Like I say, the king had regrets. But based on what the text does say, I think it's fair to come to that conclusion. It says, so after his fury had subsided, he remembered. After he was not so hot about what she'd done, and he'd calmed down a little bit, he started remembering Vashti. He was probably missing her a little bit. He missed that little twinkle in her eye, and he was never going to see it again. But his attendants couldn't allow the king to be sad, so they jumped right in. They're like, no, king, our job's to keep you always happy. So they come with a solution to cheer him up. And what grieving, power-hungry king wouldn't love to be the star of Persian Bachelor, where he gets to seek out the most beautiful young virgin in the land to be his new wife? And now, while he might not have had a lot of time to sit with his regret because people right away jumped in to cheer him up, we see it's clear how he was feeling as he was remembering Vashti, as he went down and thought about what he'd done in casting her out, that he was never going to see her again. And I think it teaches us all a valuable lesson. You're always going to regret a hasty decision made in anger. You don't see things clearly when you're mad. You lash out. You say things you don't mean. And you often make a really big mess. You leave behind a lot of regrets. Take a look at what Proverbs says in Proverbs 14:29. Whoever is patient has great understanding, but one who is quick-tempered displays folly. So don't live like the compulsive king who made a decision in his anger, which he later regretted that he could never take back. In the heat of the moment, he was like, oh, you're going to say no to me? Then be gone. Instead, take some time, sleep on these decisions, and then make a clear-headed decision later. Because you and I don't have attendants who are going to come to your aid and try to cheer you up the moment that you realize that you were a real knucklehead yesterday. So, now we pick up verse 5. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who is also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So the first thing that the author makes sure to tell us about Mordecai is that he is from the tribe of Benjamin, from the lineage of Kish. Here's a fun fact. Saul, the very first king of Israel, was also a son of Kish. And that means nothing to you today in chapter 2. But put it in your noggin, because next week in chapter 3, it's actually a huge part of the story that Mordecai is from the same lineage as King Saul was. And then while the text says Mordecai was carried away from Jerusalem with King Jehoiachin, this doesn't necessarily literally mean that he was brought along with King Jehoiachin. We have to recognize that event is very clearly defined to the year 597 BC. And King Xerxes is very well known in antiquity. And so we know that the years we're reading about where Esther is chosen as queen is the year 479 BC. That is a 118-year difference. So even if he was an infant while being brought in exile, he would be a 118-year-old man. And in those days, people simply didn't live that long. So this is, again, the author just saying, you know, we've got this man, Mordecai. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. That's going to be important. And the reason he's in Susa is because his people came when Jehoiachin was led by King Nebuchadnezzar into captivity almost 120 years ago. Fun fact, we actually have some archaeological evidence that Mordecai is a real dude who existed. It was discovered in 1904 at Persepolis, which was another Persian royal city, and it contained the name Marduka as a Persian official who served in the early years of King Xerxes' reign. And at the end of Esther, we're going to find Mordecai served as a high-ranking official under King Xerxes. So we know he was there, he served with Xerxes, we know his time and all these facts. When we look at Esther's life, we see first, she was Mordecai's cousin, and she was an orphan who was raised in his home. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, but because she lived in Persia, she also had a Persian name, and that is Esther, and that's what she's called through the remainder of the story. She was young and very beautiful with a lovely figure. The author is going out of his way to make sure that we understand she was a knockout. Okay, like there's all these adjectives put together to let us know she was an absolutely gorgeous young lady. And that sets us up for where we go in verse 8. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favor. Immediately, he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a young woman's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning, return to another part of the harem to the care of Shezgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. So we see this plan is now put into place, and all the young virgins, probably 14 to 16-year-old young ladies, are brought into the harem of the king to be prepared for a one-night stand with this 37-year-old man. And now the text never talks about this explicitly because that would be in poor taste. But this entire story, we have to recognize, is a bit in poor taste. There's a competition to prove who's the most beautiful and sexually arousing, with all the losers ultimately living out the remainder of their lives in a second living quarters without ever knowing another man, knowing love, or having children. There was a huge reward for the winner. This is a competition to be made queen. But for all the losers, they're essentially put out to pasture. Yes, they were in the palace, but they were never going to be with a man again and never have a family. And we read Esther was among the lucky ones. She was chosen to join the harem, and there she found favor with Haggai, who gave her the best of everything. It's as though he picked her as his favorite, and then he did everything he could to stack the deck, making sure that the king agreed with his selection. And during the whole process, Mordecai is keeping a close watch on her, checking on her every single day. Once a father, always a father. And then there's this short aside that explains the process of this competition, including the 12 months of beauty treatments. That's right, there's 6 months of women to be applying oil of myrrh, and then 6 months of perfumes. Ladies, pay attention. Your husbands owe you a whole bunch of myrrh and perfumes if they want you at your best. I did a quick Google search. An ounce of myrrh is had for only $100. So apparently it takes a lot of this, though. So Esther was likely brought into the king's residence 3 years after Vashti had been deposed, because we know that she was brought to the king when it was his 7th year of his reign. It had been 4 years since Vashti had been deposed. She had over a year to allow that myrrh to really soak into the skin and put her best self forward. We continue in the story, verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. Notice Esther did what she did when it was her turn. It says she only did or took with her what Haggai suggested. She wore the clothes he picked. She wore her hair how he suggested. She brought him, the king, his favorite food. Maybe she even approached the king exactly how she was told to approach him. And this wasn't the only time we see Esther being obedient to a suggestion made to her by her elders. Twice in this chapter, we're told she followed Mordecai's order to never tell people that she was a Jew. So Esther demonstrates she's willing to follow instructions. And that's really different than young people today. You see, for several generations now, baby boomers, I think you probably started this trend, you pushed back and you rebelled from your elders in significant ways. And then Gen X did the same thing, and millennials, and now we've got Gen Z. Young people want to do things their own way. They don't want to follow the advice of their parents or their teachers, or even their boss. Like, as a boss, you can be like, hey, this is how I want you to do it. And these young people can be like, nah, I don't like that. I don't want to do it that way. I've got a better way. They have a better way for everything. They think, I'm smarter than you. And here's what you have to understand, young people. If you're in a room and you're thinking, I probably know a better way to do this than you, who's older than me, then you have deceived yourselves. And you have missed the point that thinking that you know everything. Quick aside, Friday night, Michelle and I went to Des Moines. We were having date night, and we went to the mall and stopped in Barnes & Noble. I was walking past the self-help section, and this book caught my attention as I walked by. F the shoulds, do the wants. And I thought, wow, that's a title. Let's slide a curse word into the title. By your self-appointed joyologist, I don't know if you can see that, but under the name of the author, it says your joyologist. And in this book, she basically says, do whatever you want. Do what makes you happy. Don't worry about what people advise you to do. Don't do what others who have lived successfully before you have found actually works and are the keys to happiness. Just do you. Be yourself. You know what's going to make you happy. You know best. I think King Xerxes had a copy of this book by his nightstand. He was like, yeah, I can do that. Thankfully, Esther wasn't interested in this kind of garbage. She trusted and she followed the wisdom of those who had a little more experience. And so, young people, here's the point I want you to hear today. Wise people follow the wisdom of others. Wise people understand that they have a lot to offer. The author of Proverbs lays this out at the very beginning of that book of wisdom in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. It says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Fools despise advice. They despise hearing what other people think. They want to do everything on their own. Just let me figure it out. And this incredibly wise man who wrote Proverbs is like, that's idiotic. You're going to create so much more pain for yourself when others could clearly say, if you do this, you're going to experience this really bad outcome. So don't fall into that trap. prove your own wisdom and listen to the wise advice of those who have already gone through what you are going through. I used to hate taking advice. I was young once. I thought I knew better. I thought I could learn. But then there was a moment where I realized that the advice was often better than the decisions I was making. And I realized, you know what? I still have a lot to learn. I think it was like 25 years old when I realized how much I didn't know. But up to that point, I was the smartest guy in the room. It was a humbling experience, but it also helped me a lot to make better decisions, to seek out the wisdom of others. And obviously, this wisdom served Esther really well. And then what we see in this passage is ultimately Esther won. Her lovely figure, her beauty regimen, her preferential treatment in the harem, and her willingness to listen to Haggai all led to her winning the favor of the king beyond that of any of the ladies who had been with him for a single night before. The king was smitten. So he put the crown on her head, and she announced her as the queen. She called together a giant royal banquet to celebrate with all of his nobles. And he even called for a special holiday. Likely it was a tax break for all the people in Persia. So the king had one really memorable night, and everybody else got a tax-free weekend. The story is a little bit absurd. I hope you hear that. Now, we could look at Esther's win as being the result of her achievement, that somehow she knew what to do with the king. Or we could recognize it for what it is, God's hand of favor over her. Proverbs 21, verse 1 tells us, "In the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels toward all who please him." That verse fits this situation absolutely perfectly. So it's no surprise that Xerxes chose Esther. His heart was compelled by the very power of God. There is nobody else he could choose because Esther had to be in this role in this moment. And then the story takes a little bit of a twist. Verse 19 says, "When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king." So, we've got at this point, Mordecai has a position at the gate. You'll notice in this story, Mordecai seems to always be at the gate. It never says why, but most scholars agree that he must have had a position of some sort to guard this gate. And based on archaeology from Susa, we see that the king's gate is actually a really large building. So Susa is the oldest city in our current nation of Iran, and it's been fully dug up and exposed, and so you can see its foundation of all sorts of parts of the city, including the citadel, the king's palace. That's the picture on the left there. It's a massive foundation. So rendering what the drawing might have looked like in that day, we've got this picture on the right, and in the lower left-hand corner is this big building, and that's considered the king's gate. It was the entrance, the only entrance into the citadel, because there was a moat all the way around the city. And so the only way you could get into the secure residence of the king was to go right through the king's gate. And so Mordecai likely was a guard who worked at the gate, and that's why he was there so often. And that makes it much more feasible when later in this story, Mordecai is promoted into being a high-ranking advisor of the king. Now, in this portion of the text, what we see is two of the king's officers who were at the gate became angry, and they made a very regrettable decision. They decided they were going to assassinate the king. And somehow, while on the job, Mordecai either overheard them in this massive building that probably had walls that allowed sounds to just kind of ricochet all around, or it's possible that they even brought him in on their conspiracy and said, "Hey, Mordecai, this is what we're planning on doing. Are you in?" They might have assumed, because he was a Jew and he was captivity in Persia, that he'd be all too happy to join with them in their plans. But rather than allow the king of Persia, the king who rules over Mordecai's people, the Jews, to be murdered, Mordecai instead told Esther so she could warn the king. Ultimately, the plot is spoiled and the two perpetrators are killed by being impaled on really tall poles. And that's a bit of foreshadowing of what we're going to see again next week. So what we need to notice here is that regardless of Mordecai's opinion of King Xerxes, Mordecai honors the position of the king. We see that here in the Old Testament, and we also have teaching to do the exact same in the New Testament as well. In Romans chapter 13, verse 1, it says, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God." Paul is writing that to the church in Rome, who has Caesar over the top of them, who's saying, "Worship me as God." He's not making great decisions, and yet Paul is saying you have to honor the authorities put in position over you. Perhaps you're aware, in 9 days, we have an election to choose the authorities who are going to rule over us. And while we vote to put our rulers in power, we also have to recognize that the hidden hand of God is at work in establishing the authority of any person who wins. He's not sitting back right now going, "I hope my person wins. I sure hope that he gets the right number of votes." We have to recognize, even in this situation, God's saying nobody gets put in the position of authority over a nation except by his hand. And so since God plays a part in who is in authority, regardless of your politics, you must honor your governing authorities. At the end of this election, that's likely going to be neck and neck, there will be 49% of this nation who are going to be thinking, "Oh, I wish he or I wish she was not my president." We just have to understand that. Close to half of our nation is going to be disappointed. But as Christians, we can't respond the same way the world does, with anger and an unwillingness to submit to the authority of the government. If the person we want to win wins, we submit. If the person we don't want to win wins, we still submit. That's what Scripture is very clear to for us. We must respond like Mordecai, with respect for the position, regardless of who holds it. Now, as we look at this chapter as a whole, there's two major themes which are the key to seeing the hidden hand of God through this whole story: being taken and winning favor. I don't know, as I was reading this out loud, if you caught 3 times Esther was taken. It's a weird verb that she has nothing to do with these situations. Because she was an orphan, in verse 7, Mordecai had taken Esther as his own daughter. In verse 9, when the search went out for a Persian bachelor, it said Esther also was taken to the king's palace. And then in verse 16, she was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence. This theme of being taken shows that Esther's situation and circumstances were not of her own making. She didn't choose to be an orphan and be raised by Mordecai. She didn't exactly choose to be entered into this beauty contest. And she didn't choose to lose her virginity to a Gentile king. Those were the cards she was dealt. Some would say it was bad luck. Others might call it destiny. As Christians looking back, We see God's hand at play in moving her into the position that he wanted her to hold, queen of Persia. And three times, we see Esther won favor. In verse 9, it said, Esther was entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favor. Verse 15, and Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. Verse 17, and she won the king's favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. Here's where we see God's faithfulness. While Esther did not have control of her situation, God provided for her at every step. He gave her favor in every situation where she was taken. God proves that he is clearly in control in this entire story, and he's making sure that all the pieces of the game are moved exactly where he needs them, when he needs them, even if it's on a timeline that's not nearly as fast as we want. Perhaps some of you need to be reminded today that God is in control of your story, even if you don't see it. He's taking you and everyone else exactly where he needs us all to be. It might not look like a great step. In fact, you might be going through some deep pain. Remember, part of Esther's story is she's an orphan, and both her parents are dead. We forget the pain that she experienced in that, and instead we're like, yay, Esther's made queen. No, there's some real hurt here. There's some real challenges that she has to go through. But God is faithful and doesn't let her down. He doesn't let you down either. It doesn't matter if you see it, if you feel it. The fact remains, God is always at work in this world and in your life. In the good times and even in the bad, trust that God is working for your good, maybe here in this life and maybe in the next. Would you bow your heads with me as we pray?